Up next, we're going to look at the ever-changing role of presidential science advisors. For a commentary in the journal Nature this week, my next guest interviewed 7 former presidential science advisors to find out what they thought about their term as scientist-in-chief. How has the job of science advisor changed over the years and from president to president? Joining me now more to talk about it is Roger Pilkey, Jr. He is the author of that Nature commentary, also of the book The Honest Broker, Making Sense of Science and Policy and Politics. He is former director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research, professor in the Environmental Studies Program, University of Colorado in Boulder. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Pilkey.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Also with us is one of the science advisors Dr. Pilkey interviewed, Neil Lane. He served under President Clinton. He's also the former director of the National Science Foundation, and he is the Malcolm Gillis University Professor and Senior Fellow at the James A. Burke III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, and he joins us by phone from Houston. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Lane.
Thank you, Ira. Very nice to be with you today.
You're very welcome. How has Dr. Pilkey, do science advisors really make a difference in the administrations?
The role of science advisor has taken on a lot of different forms since President Eisenhower first elevated the position from the Department of Defense up into the White House. And science advisors have had an enormous difference. Probably most importantly in the thread that runs through science advice from the 1950s is its role that the office plays in the budgetary process. The science advisor is a key point for allocating resources and setting priorities with the Office of Management and Budget for how the country spends its finite research dollars.
Mm-hmm. Neil Lane, you agree?
I agree. The role has changed considerably, and certainly the formal partnership and informal relation between OSTP and the science advisor and then the Office of Management and Budget is extremely important to the budget process for science technology activities throughout the government.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about science advisors this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. The reason why I asked this is because a few years ago, I heard David Gergen give a talk at Caltech back in 1997, and he was an advisor, not the science advisor. He was a political advisor to 4 presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. And I want to play for you an edited excerpt of a speech that he gave in which he was pretty critical of how the White House did not put much weight on the input of science advisors, at least during the term that he was there, and how science advisors really did not vigorously advance their opinions to the White House staff. So here's a little bit of what he had to say.
I have a hard time remembering memos that I thought were critical to the formation of policy. But there are a lot of legislative issues that come through a White House. And yet I must tell you, I don't think the science advisor, with some exception, is seen as a critical player in a lot of those issues. Yes, their advice goes through. The scientific advisory boards that the presidents have, they have wonderfully good people on them frequently, but they don't have sufficient impact inside the process. I have been to many morning meetings, daily meetings in the White House, start at 7:30 or whatever, and the staff will be there, 25 or 30 people, and the science advisor will be there at that table. And that is the last time I see the science advisor that day. And it's again the next morning at 7:30 or 8 o'clock, I see the science advisor. And I keep asking myself, why did we run the public business this way? You know, there are so many issues on which that science advisor ought to be there.
John Marburger, is that your experience? And I had John Marburger on.
What meetings David Gergen was in, but she certainly isn't in the same kinds of meetings I am.
And there you have it. John Marburger had just become a science advisor, and I asked him if that reflected it, the way he was. He saw his role as science advisor and what happened in the White House, and he said, as you heard, he says, that's not what happened while I was there. Neil Lane, do you agree? With Marburger, or do you agree with David Gergen, who said they really didn't speak up very much and it didn't have much impact?
No, you know, I have a high regard for David Gergen, but his comments are very strange to me. Now, of course, I didn't see Gergen in the White House because I wasn't there at the same time. But after the morning staff meeting, at least my experience was that a good bit of the rest of my day, on many days, was spent in the West Wing. So they may have been meetings with John Podesta, the mm-hmm. chief of staff, or with the person who's running the Council on Environmental Quality, or Gene Sperling on economic issues, or the vice president. Meetings on budget, meetings on a number of issues, in my case, nanotechnology, and on another occasion, a meeting having to do with missile defense. So a good bit of my time, maybe more than I would have liked, was taken up with meetings in the West Wing with senior people around the president, and, of course, sometimes with the president. And obviously that's a special occasion for all of us. And we try to be on our best behavior and give our best advice at such time. So I don't, David Gergen's comments don't resonate with me.
Roger Pilkey, did you find that they reflected what you found out from all the science advisors you interviewed?
Right. The seven science advisors we talked to painted a picture that was very unique to each presidency, each science advisor, the relationship between the two of them. You go from Ed David, who was a science advisor, to Richard Nixon, who saw his position abolished by Richard Nixon, to Jack Marburger, who's the current science advisor, who saw his position demoted and his office moved down the street, to some of the stories that Neil Lane told us of very active engagement. George Keyworth, who was science advisor to Ronald Reagan, was deeply involved in the Strategic Defense Initiative, almost to the exclusion of other scientific topics. So it's important to recognize that the science advisor serves at the pleasure of the president, and the president's personality and relationship with the individual makes a huge difference as to what issues the science advisor actually participates in.
Right, we have to take a short break. We'll come back, talk lots more about president's science advisors with Neil Lane and Roger Pilkey, Jr. Take your questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note on Monday. Join Neil Conan for a conversation with Tom Brokaw. That's on Monday in this hour on Talk of the Nation. We're talking today about presidential science advisors with my guest, Roger Pilkey, Jr., a professor in the Environmental Studies Program at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Neil Lane served as science advisor to President Clinton. He's also former director of the National Science Foundation. He's now a professor at Rice University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Roger, did you finish your thought about the science advisors when we went to the break there?
Do they
have a diminished role today? Because you make a point in your piece that there's so much other advice coming from all different directions.
Yeah, I would say that diminished isn't right, because I don't think at any time in history the science advisor had a very large role. The position was created 50 years ago this month when President Eisenhower installed James Killian in the aftermath of Sputnik to show the American public that the U.S. was on top of scientific issues dealing with missiles in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. But almost immediately after that, the science advisor took on a role that is remarkably similar to today. So if there was a golden age of science advice, it was remarkably short, and science advisors slipped into these very unique roles that have gone up and down over time. But at no time would you have seen a science advisor who has a position like, say, Karl Rove does in the current administration.
Neil Lane, would you agree that it's just about been steady?
Well, I certainly agree. I never saw my role as similar to Karl Rove.
Yeah.
But I would agree with Roger in that I don't think the role has diminished. Probably the time when the role was most powerful was when it wasn't really called science advisor. It was wartime advisor Vannevar Bush, who had not only the advisory role, but he also had the money and the priority setting. I think the science advisor for most of the history has served the role it does today. Science technology are central to everything. The science advisor really has to bring to the president all of the knowledge base and all the advice coming from these various agencies that Roger talks about in his piece, and be a sort of honest broker, to use Roger's book title, in getting that information to the president. So the science advisor gives confidential advice to the president. He or she serves as director of OSTP, which is the knowledge base for science technology in the White House, and he serves as the president's spokesperson on science and technology matters. I think probably the science advisor in the future will be even more important than that role has been in the past because of the point Roger makes in his piece, the complexity of science and technology. It just connects with everything that has to do with people's lives and with every important policy issue. So I look for the role to be increasingly important, but also increasingly complicated in the years to come.
Brian in Portland, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi there.
My comment, I just want to get the opinion of the guest about the current president, who has really just denied an awful lot of science and just doesn't seem to put any faith in it, from issues ranging from global warming to the intelligent design versus evolution debate. And I just wanted to hear their opinion. I'm like, what does a science advisor do if the president just doesn't believe science?
I'm happy to comment.
Go ahead, Neil.
You want me to lead off?
Sure.
Let me say that I'm unfamiliar with that kind of White House. That was not the kind of White House I worked in. And my predecessor, Jack Gibbons, you can bet, was intimately involved in all the discussions about climate change. And he had the advice of an expert, Rosina Baerbaum, and her predecessors in OSTP. So no question but what they were fully consulted, and I can show you a pile of memos, mm-hmm. if you like, on that. The current administration has been different, and I can resonate with the comments our questioner made. But I also have to say the science advisor can only give advice to the president, and that advice really needs to be confidential advice. And then the president does what he does and says what he says, further influenced by any of his aides. So I can imagine it's a very frustrating job for Jack Marburger, but I think that's the situation we've been in for a while.
Roger, has there ever been as much scrutiny of science advisors as there has been under this administration?
I'll give you a yes and no to that. Richard Nixon, as I mentioned, got rid of the office. Mm-hmm. To answer the caller, what do you do when a president decides that he doesn't want a particular set of advice or information? In that case, it took an act of Congress to get the science advisor back into the White House. So I think it's very idiosyncratic. It depends on the nature of the president and the way they receive advice. The current administration is widely reported to have a very narrow circle of advisors, whether it's the issue of going to war in Iraq or stem cell policy. This is the nature of this particular presidency, and I agree with Neil that looking back over, say, the Clinton administration, it was a very different approach to how expertise was managed and used.
So if you're a science advisor or a potential advisor and you get the call from the White House to come on over, you sign up, right? You then sign up for this administration that you will go along and be very quiet, at least publicly, about the policy because that you are a spokesperson.
That's absolutely correct. And if the president actually says something factually wrong about science, then maybe that just goes by. But if the science advisor gets questioned about that, that puts the science advisor in a dilemma. He or she's just got to figure out how to protect the president as best you can and protect your own integrity and the integrity of your office. That's sometimes very hard.
Do you think there could ever be a case where you think that your integrity is so on the line there that you might find yourself having to resign over the policies taken by a White House?
That could be the case.
Mm-hmm. Roger, has that ever happened?
It has never happened, but it certainly could be the case. And in that respect, the science advisor is not unlike any other presidential appointee. At some point, if the policies of the administration are such that the individual can't support them, then they always have that option to leave the administration.
Mm-hmm. And as you point out, there have been other cases where the science has been politicized in other administrations.
If you look across history, you'll find that as science and technology have increasingly played a role in policy issues, whether it's aluminum tubes in the debate over the war in Iraq, stem cell policies, mm-hmm. climate change, the more political importance that science and technology takes on, the more politicized scientific debates become.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, you can look back even to the Eisenhower administration and see many of the earlier incarnations of the same sort of debates we see over science today.
Mm-hmm. Neil, a question comes in from Bauer in Second Life, who says, Jimmy Carter was a scientist and understood anything he read. Is the typical office holder even capable of understanding the things that are needed for making these kinds of decisions?
Well, I think no matter what the background of the president is, of course, you want a president who's intelligent and knows a lot and understands how to sort out differing opinions. But the complexity of science, engineering, technology issues today is such that the president, I believe, must have immediate at hand an advisor and a body of expertise like the Office of Science, Technology, Policy I talked about earlier, mm-hmm. that can respond quickly and give him a correct understanding of what science is and even perhaps policy options in the way that Roger has talked about to cut through then a lot of otherwise time-consuming make-work.
Mm-hmm. But if the president's not interested in hearing what the real science is, it doesn't matter what you say to him.
Well, that's right. And you know, it's how we can only know if we're not inside the White House. We can only know from outside how it appears, and certainly appears in the current administration that that there was not only a lack of interest there, but also a lack of respect for science, because many of the things the administration has done were, I think, unique in the history of the presidency. The idea of falsifying statements about the facts of science in ways that mislead the public, somewhat unusual, and that's why many of us spoke out in 2004.
Mm-hmm. So going forward, Roger Pilkey, what do you think, then, the role of a science advisor should be?
One thing that struck me most when I was writing the piece for Nature was how expertise in government has literally exploded. I quote William Golden, who wrote in 1950, one of the architects of the science advisor position, that the government could look to between 20 and 200 top scientists to provide advice. Today, there's more than 18,000 scientists who serve on actual formal advisory committees to the government. That's not counting all of the non-governmental organizations, international organizations, independent scientists that are out there ready and willing to provide advice. So it seems to me that I agree with Neil. Looking to the future, the management of all of this wonderful expertise is going to become more and more important. The president simply cannot be on top of all of these topics all the time and has to lean on experts. As far as policymaking goes, if policy is not connected to cause and effect relationships about the real world, those policies aren't going to do what they're intended to do, and we'll see some bad failures. So it's of utmost importance that expertise gets brought into the policy process in a way that's accurate and contributes to effective policymaking.
Stephen in Phoenix, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Neil, I appreciate your time. I'm sorry, it's Mr. Pilkey and Mr. Lane and Ira, right?
It's Friday.
I use science daily to save the lives of my patients. I'm an infectious disease doctor. You know, our current administration is hostile to science, I think, and I agree with everything you've said. Daily, there's doctors and scientists that are taken to task for raising quality issues either at hospitals or at drug companies or in the government. And I just want to know what we scientists can do, or doctors, or people that raise quality issues, about being muzzled. You know, how can we prevent this? I mean, the stem cell research, global warming, it seems common sense has just gone out the window. We're teaching creationism in schools, and, you know, when those kids have to know science to stop bioterrorism agents or build things, you know, they're not going to have that background.
Well, this is Neil. May I comment on that?
Sure, please.
Thank you very much for the question. It gives me a chance to give my civic scientist speech, but I'll avoid that temptation. I think there's no magic bullet here that scientists, and I include medical scientists, the physicians, engineers, technical professions of all kinds, really need more than ever to get outside their labs and their offices some of the time and interact with the public, get into a dialogue with the general public. Only that way are we going to establish the sort of mutual respect and understanding with the public and their elected representatives that we need. We'll have to work at this over a long period of time. It's nothing that's just going to be suddenly fixed, because this is not just a problem with one individual who happens to be president of the United States. In fact, we've never said this individual is personally responsible for all the things that have gone on that we've been talking about here. it does represent, though, some disturbing trends in our larger society, and that has something to do with the quality of education and leadership that we've enjoyed, that we've lacked, actually, in this nation over some period.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Neil Lane, who's a professor at Rice University, also with Roger Pilkey, who's author of The Honest Broker, Making Science a Sense of Science in Policy and Politics. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get another call or two in here. Let's go this time to Oakland. Hi, Hugh. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, this is Hugh in Oakland. My father worked for years for NASA in the International Division, which is a small division of NASA, and which in turn is a small division of the government. And what they found often was that things would be said either in the Senate or to the public through the science advisor that the administration in power did not want to say publicly. And usually that meant two things. One, concerning NASA, that the science advisor would be the hatchet man for cutting an already small agency's budget. And that was pretty much with any administration. And then secondly, there's a lot of industry input into science policy, and that would often be done through the science office. So I'd like your guest's comments both about that, but I'd also like to point out to the public that they can pay attention in any administration about what they really mean by what the science advisor is saying and not the administration itself.
Neil, did you find that to be true?
I think it's generally correct that that the science advisor is often the spokesperson for a particular policy that the administration has. And that may be a policy that he or she agrees with or not. That's different from, you know, being asked to misstate scientific fact or that one really couldn't do, I think, under the circumstances. But it is not uncommon for the science advisor to state a policy and defend a policy that he or she might not personally like. And I, you know, our caller talks about NASA. I mean, what an extraordinary agency with a history of accomplishment, and yet an agency that's been put through some really difficult times. And now, of course, is in, I think, some serious trouble when we really ought to be paying a little more attention to the future opportunities in space.
Roger, any last comment?
Yeah, I would say that the overall budget for research and development in this country is extremely fortunate to have the science advisor, because ultimately budget decisions are made in a political way. But having the science advisor as kind of the chief budget officer working with OMB, looking at that helps to ensure that scientific judgments on priorities get put into the process in a way that maybe wouldn't if there wasn't this cross-cutting look at the budget process.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both, gentlemen. Taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, and have a happy holiday season to you.
Thank you, Ira. Come
happy see us at
Rice University.
We'll come down there. Neil Lane has served as science advisor under President Clinton. He is the Malcolm Gillis University Professor and Senior Fellow at the James Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice. Roger Pilkey, Jr. is the author of The Honest Broker, Making Sense of Science and Policy and Politics. He is a professor in the Environmental Studies Program at the University of Colorado in Boulder. I want to thank them again for joining us today.